questions for specific presenters that you would like to talk. So does anybody have a kind of brief reaction or response to any other panelist?
Well, sure.
Gosh, where to start? Well, just with respect to the last point that you were making about the inference to the best explanation, of course, we all understand that science is a provisional endeavor and that explanations that are put forward are defeasible. So the point about inferring what is a sufficient cause to explain a phenomenon with respect to ID, I'm afraid that the way that you presented the inference to the, to the best explanation might be regarded as casting ID as an argument from ignorance, which it is not. An argument from ignorance would say that natural processes are insufficient to the explanation of a phenomenon, therefore ID. And the actual ID argument would be natural causes are insufficient to explain the origin of specified information that is exemplified in a particular physical or biological system, but intelligent causes from contemporary experience, repeated experience, historical experience are known to be sufficient to explain such things. In fact, they're the only thing that's known to be sufficient to explain such things. So in the absence of any other option, intelligent design is the best explanation for such things. And of course, that's provisional. If something else comes along, then that explanation can be replaced. But it is the best explanation available to science at a particular time. And the other point that I wanted to make is, yes, you give an example of SETI and forensics and archaeology and so on and so forth as sciences in which inferences to intelligent causation are made. And that's true enough. And those very same methodologies, mathematically rendered, can be applied to an examination of nature itself. And if we find the same sort of mathematical patterns evinced in nature that we find in explanations being used in, say, the more human sciences, then it would seem to be a double standard that essentially appeals to methodological naturalism as a restrictive principle that would preclude the same conclusion from being drawn when those methodologies are successfully applied to nature itself. So I would say that there's a double standard involved there with respect to when you can use the methodology, when the methodology seems to be applicable in both instances.
Yeah, thank you. I think those are really astute observations.
The microphone's only for the recording. There's no other amplification to speak
up. Okay. Could you guys hear that last?
Did you hear what I said? Because I'd hate to repeat it all.
I could probably use your repeating it all. I guess with regards to the inference to the best explanation argument, I would say I think there's quite a bit of disagreement as to whether the current explanations, natural explanations which are out there for complex specified information, say in DNA, are insufficient. I think my misunderstanding always of ID, I've never quite grasped why it is that the only examples we have of intelligent causation of complex information seem to be human ones from our own experience. When I look at the natural world and I see that every single living thing has DNA as its basic blueprint, if you will, I think that argues that there's an entire, you know, universe of nucleotide information that has been produced. And to say that it could only be the result of you know, direct intervention of a mind, I think open up some cans of worms that scientists aren't sufficiently ready to kind of move away from that.
I agree that they're not sufficiently ready to move away from that. And I think that that attitude is constrained by a presumption of methodological naturalism. When
you can offer in principle considerations like Polanyi's for thinking that various hypotheses like the RNA world or metabolism first are going to be insufficient. And when you look at the processes, I mean, the ribozymes that exist in nature are not anywhere nearly as effective or specified as the actual enzymes that play a role in protein synthesis. And so to suggest that an RNA catalyst functioning as an enzyme itself could somehow bootstrap the whole process into existence is problematic, particularly if you consider the original environment in which there are interfering cross-reactions, and it just doesn't seem like it's going to be a sufficient basis. In fact, so much so that you have people like Eugene Koonin at the National Center for Biology Information actually appealing to the multiverse as an explanation of the origin of life. So in a 2007 paper that appeared in Biology Direct, he essentially appealed to the idea of an infinite multiverse in which every finite area of space then, in terms of material configuration, gets repeated infinitely many times, provides a thoroughly naturalistic basis for explaining how you could get a self-replicating structure in biology. He sees the situation, as respect the origin of life at least, as just that desperate. Again, that sort of Hail Mary pass seems to indicate that maybe we need to be looking in another direction. And as you pointed out, and as many of the speakers have pointed out, the history of science bears evidence that the Judeo-Christian conception of reality is what gave birth to the investigation of nature. And the idea that there's contingency.
There's no reputable historian of science who would agree with that statement.
No reputable historian of science would...
I do not know one.
Would,
say that again.
Okay. What are you disagreeing with?
That science came exclusively from the Judeo-Christian tradition. That's a Christian conceit.
Certainly, there were evidences in Greek conception
that... In Arabic?
Sure. Well, okay. Than, let's say, a theistic conception of nature.
The Greeks are pretty theistic.
Well, Plato was.
May I say something?
Yes, you may, absolutely.
Okay. I just wanted to comment on your paper.
Okay.
I appreciated the enthusiasm with which you were destroying so-called methodological naturalism. However, I couldn't think of a single advocate of methodological naturalism who would agree with your definition. Historically, I've never heard anybody come close to saying methodological naturalism means that you must restrict yourself to deterministic, materialistic explanations. It is reduced by almost everybody to the simple formula, no supernatural explanations allowed. Every example you gave did not... or no example you gave, invoke the supernatural. So you're talking right past the people who have advocated methodological naturalism over the centuries.
Well, no supernatural explanations allowed. It's somewhat problematic as a definition of methodological naturalism.
Well, it's simpler than yours, though.
Well, it is. It's simple. It's easy to understand, but
it's true.
No, it's what are the implications of the science itself? Is what I'm asking in my paper. And my paper or my presentation was pointing in the direction of, okay, these things need an explanation. And if you say no supernatural explanations allowed, then you have no explanation. Now, if you want to say that that's not a scientific conclusion, fine. But if you're wanting to say that you have to restrict your science to no supernatural implications, then obviously you've got a problem, because there seems to be an inference here just waiting to be made to a supernatural cause. So do we say, okay, let's pursue the science and do it in an instrumental fashion and deny that the implication is there, or say that we're firm methodological naturalists, so we have to interpret this instrumentally, because if we interpret realistically, there is obviously a cause that transcends material causes that is necessary to explain the effect. What do you do?
I don't follow your argument. I was much more convinced by Catherine's explanation, which I think comports with what most advocates of methodological naturalism believe it does, the limitations and what it allows.
I don't think it excludes any.
It hasn't historically, and only for advocates of intelligent design would it exclude. Would it be the equivalent of atheistic or metaphysical naturalism? But that's not what the advocates I think are saying. And you can talk.
I appreciate some of the examples you gave of the way in which methodological naturalism points toward intelligent design. For example, the Big Bang Theory points toward the idea of a creator, but I don't see where intelligent design helps in the process of explanation. Can you give an example of where intelligent design actually advances science intrinsically?
Well, when we were talking about biology, for example, I gave those 12 predictions of ID that wouldn't conform to an explanation that was conducted within the context of methodological naturalism. In fact, if you're looking for an example in which methodological naturalism or a neo-Darwinian assumption actually serves as kind of a science stopper itself, because, you know, every research program has questions that it's interested in, right, and which emerge from it. And neo-Darwinism generates different questions than ID generates. But that creates, if you like, certain blind spots that are endemic to various research programs. So take the question of junk DNA, for instance. Back in the 80s, Leslie Orgel and Francis Crick came out with a paper that essentially was an advocating the selfish DNA hypothesis that and constrained by the central dogma that Crick had put forward that DNA makes RNA makes proteins. That's just what DNA is for. And they said, and so it's not surprising that, you know, and that, of course, only accounts for about 1.5% of the genome. What about the other 98.5%? They were happy to regard it and stated it as such as just so much evolutionary piggybacking, flotsam and jetsam in our genome that was carried along by the evolutionary process. And you can understand that because explaining the origin of that information is difficult enough just for the 1.5% of the genome that codes for proteins. If you discover that the other 98.5% represents a very intricate RNA operating system that sequences the order in which operations are carried out and is kind of a, even with the repetitive DNA, functioning as a file system in three dimensions that brings things into, Catherine, you're probably going to want to respond to this. I mean, this is Rick Sternberg's view. Now, I'm not, I admit, a biologist. I'm more of a physicist in terms of my training. So we'll see where we get in the discussion of the biology. I'd feel much more comfortable if Rick Sternberg, for instance, were taking this part of the discussion. However, the point being that on an ID hypothesis, the idea that the genome is mostly junk is not what one would expect. And so ID theorists well back into the 90s were saying, hey, we need to look for what the non-protein coding portions of the genome actually represent and what they're actually doing. Because in many cases, they're conserved from generation to generation. Even things that represent pseudogenes are conserved from generation to generation. And if you assume evolutionary continuity, common descent, you see them appearing in different species as well. So they must be performing, even on a neo-Darwinian basis, some function if they're preserved without gross errors being introduced in the copying process. You need a selective basis for their preservation in an evolutionary worldview. So So there's a tension there in terms of the origin of the information and the conservation of the information from the neo-Darwinian perspective that is not there in the ID perspective. And the ID perspective suggests that we need to be looking for function in so-called junk DNA, whereas for Orgel and Crick, for instance, that was kind of a science stopper. They said, essentially, let's not waste our time on this.
Catherine, quick response, then I want to shift to the audience.
Sure. I think there's you talked about a lot of different things that we could respond to. Just want to respond to a couple. I think we get so used to the metaphors we use for biological processes and entities that they can shape our understanding of what's actually going on. So talking even as I just did, referred to DNA as a blueprint, may not be a functionally good way of thinking about it. And I think similarly, thinking of the genome as an operating system and all of these complex circuits, these are analogies we make to help us understand it based on other principles we know. And certainly there is a great amount of design. There is operationally, I think, you know, functionally, it's very complex and there's lots of unanswered questions. But I think the that tends to blind us then to other explanations for how that might originate. So it's very easy for us to imagine God as a sort of computer programmer up in the sky. Not that I'm implying that's what ID theorists do necessarily, but I think it's for the layperson, you get the sense that God has just, you know, programmed all DNA and that all DNA works just, you know, from one generation to the next. Really, it's much more complicated than that.
Yeah, and ID doesn't deny that.
Right, yes, I did want to provide that.
Okay, good. Okay. Good, because I want to make sure the audience has some time to interact. I think one of the things that you can see from that the historical perspective that part of this symposium has been is that it reflects something or reveals something about this sort of strand of the conversation. That's that when you look prior to about halfway through the 19th century, to think anachronistically, methodological naturalism is simply a description of how all theists saw an appropriate way of trying to understand God's creation. From at least the middle of the 19th century forward, methodological naturalism seems to function more as a demarcation criteria between what's scientific and what's something else. That's the nice way of putting it. The darker way of putting it is that it serves as a kind of club to beat various camps over the head. And that, I think, shows that there is some kind of significant change in how people think about science pre, say, 19th century and then after we get through the 19th century. So now I saw, I think you had your hand up first, right?
Yes. I think I explained why it's not God of the gaps in terms of an account, a mathematical account of when design inferences are warranted, and that being the case on the basis of our knowledge of what intelligent causes are sufficient to produce and what natural causes are sufficient to produce. And so now I will grant you that intelligent design is theistically friendly, all right? And some people may want to go on and develop a form of scientific apologetics, if that's not anathema, on the basis of ID sorts of considerations. But they're not doing science when they're doing that. they're extending the philosophical implications of the theory and constructing an argument on its basis. I think we as Christians need to be very resistant to the idea of a subtraction story, as Charles Taylor would call it, of the history of science being one in which naturalistic explanation advances and God retreats. I think if you look objectively at the implications of various scientific theories, from the Big Bang to quantum mechanics, and to some of the phenomena that we're seeing in biology, God hasn't really retreated at all in terms of a larger metaphysical sense of our understanding of his involvement in the quotidian course of nature. And it would be a mistake to cede that territory to those who would claim otherwise. Now, I will grant that over the course of the development of how science is conceived in the academy, that that is the received view. But I see no reason to accept it at face value, and I would very much like to develop a conception of science that doesn't rely upon it and an understanding of the history of science that says, yeah, this is the main way that things have developed and naturalism has hegemony in the modern academy, and there is a socio-historical explanation for that, but in terms of epistemology and metaphysics, it's far from necessary. And here's another way of looking at things. So I don't think we as Christians need to be afraid of how science is going to develop. I don't think we need to be afraid of the fact that certain examples of ID where it's put forward might eventually turn out to be incorrect. We have a larger picture of how nature functions that can take that in stride. Pardon? As... well, I mean, we have agnostics that embrace ID. We have Jews. We have Muslims. We have, you know, there are a variety of people who embrace ID as worth pursuing as a potential explanation. And, I mean, are you concerned about, some people have put forward an argument on the basis of theodicy, as if evolution somehow and natural selection as a mechanism provides us a way of dealing with the problem of evil in the world. Are you worried about concerns like that? Or are you worried about the fact that, okay, we're putting ID forward as an explanation, it's associated in the public mind as something that is somehow specifically Christian, and if it proves to be incorrect in this area, then they're going to reject the idea of Christianity? Is that your fundamental concern?
That seems to be what he's articulating.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it is quite confusing, but natural philosophy, it was the traditional term that everybody would have used. The new experimental philosophy would have been a very common 17th century term, or natural philosophy, so that's, everybody would have wrapped it into that. I don't know if Ron may want to expand maybe on your comments.
As far as I know, there were no synonyms for this approach. They were just descriptions of how one would limit the explanations that were allowed. So no miracles in natural philosophy. Some might say, let's limit ourselves to things that are predictable. But there was no synonymous term that was antecedent to methodological naturalism that I've ever run across.
No, I think it's unfortunate that we've divorced science from natural philosophy because we're doing natural philosophy whether we realize it or not.
Well, that's a fair enough question. And as much as we appreciate our scientists and their accomplishments, there's a tremendous amount left to be done. So just take your one example, the origin of life. What you don't want to do is say, God did it, we don't have to explore it. There are lots of people around the world now working on that very topic. Maybe they're going to strike out. Maybe they won't come up with an explanation, but at least it's an ongoing research project, and the same would apply to the other examples you gave. So, you know, it's just a challenge for the future. The fact that we don't have all question answered now shouldn't be held against science, I think. No. Or at least possible ones. But if you've made progress over the century with methodological naturalism, I think the assumption is in the scientific communities that are working on these problems, we're going to do better in the future if we stick to this agenda rather than just saying it was supernatural. Let me just address another point that you made. One of the other things that makes it appear as though science has pushed religion to the periphery is that in another sense it has. Not only has it not allowed supernatural explanations to count as scientific explanations, but the very practice of science in the late 19th century became highly privatized in the sense of moving philosophical and religious ideas out of scientific literature. And scientists tried to depersonalize what they were doing. You start seeing it written in the passive voice with no actors. You see the total absence of God talk. You can't publish an article in the late 19th, early 20th century that says, okay, even though I don't invoke God as a mechanism, I believe that this evidence testifies to God. You publish that in private religious journals or something like that, so that religion does get evacuated from scientific discourse. And whether it's being evacuated from the larger culture is another question.
Physical explanation.
Yeah, no physical explanation. But none of my atheist friends seem to be inclined to take that evidence for the time. In all my physics research work, I've given lots of arguments and discussions about things that we're trying to sort out, but we've never resorted to the idea that God can be invoked in some kind of principle like that logical naturalism. And I think this is actually related to the fact that in physics textbooks there is never a discussion about. We know when we're getting something right or wrong, because the data sort of comes out and it's a mathematics. But looking as an outsider to the biology and evolution discussion, that's what was surprising. And then Robert brought up the issue of is this kind of a closet demarcation camera. You know, are you really just trying to keep people out by invoking that logic and naturalism? Why don't you just get down to the big
I think your what lies in the background of your question is our sort of modern use or contemporary use of methodological naturalism as a kind of club or demarcation, as opposed to just saying that, why don't we just do it? Well, the way I often put it to my students is, why don't we just continue to do science the Christian way, Newton, Boyle, et cetera, and throw all these clubs out and let Richard Dawkins realize that he's, you know, drawing on borrowed resources. But they like that, but that oversimplifies things a bit. But I think it does highlight the fact that methodological naturalism plays an extremely different role in both our rhetoric and our thinking about science. It's not clear it plays that big a role in terms of the actual practice of bench scientists. So I think, you know, Newton would have shared Newton and Boyle would have shared some of the puzzlement of a lot of bench scientists about why are we having all this blow up all the time about this over and over again.
Yeah, I would just like to add, I think as I conceive it, it's more of it's a tradition, it's a convention. I think of it much more rather like the pragmatism of the fact that it works, which I invoked admittedly more as an argument for it. I think that's true. I tend to conceive of it much more as a presupposition of science, of how science is done, rather than something that science itself can sort of prove as a useful practice. I mean, I guess it's kind of like the principle of uniformity, you know, that we can look in this part of the universe and see one explanation hold true. Why is it rational to presume that it's going to be this way somewhere else in the universe? I think that's a presupposition of science that can't be proved from science. And I think there's rational explanations for why we do that, which is, you know, from my understanding of the history, at least, it is certainly consistent with the Christian notion of a God who is regular and uniform and rational, and that the world is intelligible because of that. And so I would say, you know, in a similar way, methodological naturalism, I mean, I've never had a conversation with it, about it, with other, you know, secular scientists. It's just not an issue. It's just the air we breathe. It's how we do science. And I think that's why we don't discuss it very much. It's my perspective.
Also, the American context is somewhat distinctive because we have been influenced so much by constitutional constraints and judicial decisions here. I've never been impressed historically by fixed demarcation criteria. I think they're always negotiated. But I was involved in the early 80s in the Louisiana creation evolution trial and was deposed for a few days. And I wanted to argue, well, let's decide which theories are more fruitful scientifically rather than just taking an arbitrary demarcation line there. And I was promptly told that I was worthless if I did that because it's not unconstitutional to teach bad science. So arguing that creationism or intelligent design is bad science is not unconstitutional. So we've had a series of cases now for since the late 60s, and you know, the creationists tried to get to use getting into the school curriculum. The intelligent design people in Dover were trying.
Well, was not the intelligent design people. That was the Dover.
Yeah.
Certain people.
Michael Behe is not part of your group, I guess.
Behe was deposed as a witness at the trial in relationship to.
Just giving you a hard time. I know the Discovery.
Discovery Institute vehemently opposed what the Dover School Board was trying to do because it saw the debacle that would ensue.
I don't.
All right. Thank you.
David. Oh, okay. Quickly.
Because still being told by philosophers that there are demarcation criteria.
Michael Ruse was the culprit in that instance in Louisiana.
Yes, he was. And he was wrong.
And he knew he was wrong.
And
And that's okay.
That's the thing that's gone. Anyway, sorry.
Perhaps. David?
Thinking God's thoughts after him conceptually doesn't sound like methodological naturalism. Newton would have expressed. Now we are putting historically a term back on previous scientists that I think Newton would have been totally confounded by the term.
Sure.
Related to, so to impose methodological naturalism onto Newton, I'm very uncomfortable with that. Talking with Gerald here about the origin of the term, in a break here, that Paul DeVries came up with this historically at a time when there was, and I'm coining a term, methodological young earth creationism, which was coming in. And if you're a good young earth creationist, you know before you start what the evidence is going to be. You don't have to do the experiment. You know that whatever thing related to date, it's going to be 6,000 years, or if you're really liberal, maybe 10,000 years. So to come up with a concept that constrains how we think based on some really bad science, I'm putting my thoughts into here, but it seems to me historically that maybe this is a reaction, an overreaction possibly, to methodological young earth creationism. The idea of methodological neutralism. Let the evidence go wherever it will go.
Yeah, so I think, there certainly is something anachronistic about describing or projecting methodological naturalism in the past. However, if you were to interview Boyle and Newton and Galileo and others and ask them about to describe how they do their actual study of nature, most of us, they would say that that's exactly the injunction that methodological naturalism tells us. Explain natural phenomena in terms of natural processes. But by none of that do they mean that God's not involved in the natural processes. There might be differences in how he's involved, right? So the thing that's significant about the use today is it's basically methodological naturalism by many gets sort of pumped up or inflated into, in essence, a kind of metaphysical naturalism, that there cannot be any such kind of God. There can only be the material order, the forces, the fields, et cetera, whatever there is that makes up a kind of physical reality. So then you get into questions about causal closure, reductionism, et cetera. They all get nettled together. So I think it's one more question back here before we're out of.
It's worth exploring, and there is a fairly rich history in the medical world too.
Because there was that same concept of this is the body and life, and then it.
Although surprisingly, medicine became natural. Most of medicine became naturalistic before most of science did.
One example would be the germ theory of disease, that attempt to assign disease to some supernatural cause was finally replaced by what I would call methodological naturalists and following up a theory like that.
So thank you very much for coming to our really long, too long symposium.